Today is March the 24th, 2021. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. In the news, IRS changed the April 15th filing deadline to May 17. T-Mobile and Dish go to battle over CDMA support for Mobile Boost. T-Mobile customers are getting a free Pandora app that features SiriusXM content. Cable TV subscribers are not cord cutters, they're just switching the cord. And new technology developments in the hard disk drive. Feature segments this evening. Benjamin Rockwell with Upsides of Tech and Business Force. From the Tech Corner, is there a best programming language? How will the work office transform post-pandemic? Workers are moving first, asking questions later. What happens when offices reopen? And Marty Winston with lots of meeting cheating. The Internal Revenue Service has a message for everyone. They're delaying April 15th as a tax filing deadline by 1 month. But there's one caveat. The Internal Revenue Service said it's pushing the tax filing deadline from April 15th to May 17th. The IRS commissioner said this continues to be a tough time for many people, and the IRS wants to continue to do everything possible to help taxpayers navigate the unusual circumstances related to the pandemic, while also working on important tax administration responsibilities. After a later-than-usual February 12th start in the income tax filing season, the April 15th deadline was arriving too soon, according to accountants, certain lawmakers, and advocates for elderly taxpayers. More than 100 members of the House of Representatives signed a letter asking the IRS to postpone the deadline. It's also been a challenging time for the IRS. The tax collection agency was facing mounting pressure for more filing time, especially now that President Joe Biden signed a $1.9 trillion financial rescue bill packed with various tax code changes. The IRS has to put those changes into effect, especially one provision that waives federal income tax on the first $10,200 a person receives in jobless benefits. The IRS also has to distribute a third round of stimulus checks. The IRS has already distributed 90 million economic impact payments valued at more than $242 billion. Last year, the IRS pushed the deadline to July 15th, also due to the pressures from the COVID-19 pandemic. This year, the IRS was under pressure to push the deadline back pretty much as soon as tax season started. The May 17th deadline is the deadline to pay any taxes owed, and it is the deadline to submit a return. People can still get an extension to October 15th, but that's only more time to send in the return, and it does not afford more time to pay taxes. There are exceptions. Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana residents still have a slightly longer time frame to file their taxes. People in those states were previously given a June 15th deadline to file and pay taxes because of the debilitating winter storm that swept through those states in February. T-Mobile and Dish goes to battle over Boost. Dish relies on thousands of dealers across the country who sell the Boost mobile prepaid brand. And here's a review of the latest developments in the ongoing dispute between T-Mobile and Dish. Fox News interviewed T-Mobile CEO Mike Stievert about its 5G rollout, and near the end of the segment, Liz Claman asked about T-Mobile shutting off the old Sprint 3G CDMA network. According to Dish, T-Mobile is waiting in the wings to grab Boost Mobile customers as its own when their CDMA handsets no longer work. T-Mobile responded that of about 9 million Boost customers, almost 90% of them will already have a handset that's compatible with the T-Mobile network by the end of this year. Nobody's having anything unplugged. By the time the network transmitter happens next year, there will be customers in the single digits percentage who are affected by the shutdown. Traditionally, what happens during these transitions is the operator, in this case Dish, just takes care of that with incentives and promotions. What's in the public interest is getting 5G installed as quickly as possible. Dish bought Boost as part of the remedy in the government agreeing to the $26 billion T-Mobile-Sprint merger. Now, Dish is facing a massive problem getting the Boost customers, many of them low-income, equipped with compatible handsets when the CDMA network shuts down. Boost provided the following statement in response to T-Mobile. A majority of our 9 million Boost subscribers have devices that rely on Sprint CDMA network and will be harmed if T-Mobile prematurely shuts down that network. T-Mobile's statement that 90% of those subscribers will have a T-Mobile compatible device by year's end reinforces our view they are planning to directly attack Boost customers with an accelerated shutdown in order to churn customers directly to T-Mobile. As discussed during our conference call, we believe this is highly anti-competitive. We hope that T-Mobile reconsiders its decision to shut down the CDMA network prematurely so 100% of Boost subscribers will not be impacted and Dish can continue providing consumers with competitive choices. According to T-Mobile, though, it gave Dish notice back in October 2020 that it would be switching the network, and it insists that's enough time for Dish to convert to customers. According to T-Mobile, the phase-out of 2G, 3G technologies across the wireless industry is a natural evolution. In T-Mobile's case, this transition is essential to the creation of the ultra-high-capacity 5G network we have committed to deliver for customers and to the government. We all want to make sure no customers are left behind, and we are following a tried and true process to achieve that goal. Everything we're doing here is exactly consistent with the agreement that Dish made with us a year and a half ago, and we have been very proactive and transparent about the timing for this transition with all our MVNOs, which means Mobile Virtual Network Operator, including Dish. We gave Dish notice in October of 2020 for a January 1st, 2022 transition, far more than the required six-month contractual agreement. Our agreement with Dish is also clear that they are responsible for migrating Boost customers just as we are responsible for migrating Sprint customers, and we are confident that Dish is already making plans to take care of their impacted customers prior to the transition date. Given the advance notice that they received, just a small percentage of Boost customers should need to upgrade their handsets by the end of this year, and typically those customers would be supported with incentives and promotions to get their handsets upgraded. As for whether T-Mobile will be moving all of its own CDMA customers to a network by the start of 2022, a spokesperson for T-Mobile said they will be migrating customers by January 1, 2022, and is planning to offer incentives for customers to upgrade old, incompatible phones. It's a quandary. Does Dish move the Boost customers with the CDMA handsets over to LTE before they ultimately end up with 5G handsets? Dish is using T-Mobile's network in an MVNO arrangement. Essentially, it's a fancy way to describe a small carrier that pays one of the big three to provide. But Dish's own 5G network, which provides owner's economics, won't be ready in time for the CDMA transition, if it occurs, as stated, by January 1, 2022. In contrast, prepaid rivals Metro by T-Mobile and AT&T Cricket brand are touting deals for 5G phones. Unlike Metro and Cricket, Boost has only two high-end handset variants. At early 2021, Metro by T-Mobile offered the OnePlus Nord N10 5G as a free 5G phone for switchers. As Dish prepares for the CDMA network shutdown, we'll see if the regulators are going to get involved. T-Mobile customers are getting a free Pandora app that features SiriusXM content. SiriusXM has owned Pandora since 2018, but we haven't seen content from the two brands overlap too often in that time. Well, that's about to change thanks to a new joint promotion between SiriusXM and T-Mobile. Starting on March the 23rd, which was yesterday, the carrier will offer its customers a new and enhanced version of Pandora app that includes ad-free weekend listening through March 2022 and a top tracks hub powered by SiriusXM. The latter will feature songs from channels like The Highway and Hits 1. You'll also get access to original audio shows in addition to early access to Pandora's podcasts like The Holder Show. The fact that you can only get this version of Pandora as a T-Mobile customer, well, it's a bit strange, but it's a smart move on SiriusXM part nonetheless. Pandora's union with SiriusXM is one of the things that helped Pandora differentiate itself from competitors like Spotify. To check out the app, start by downloading the T-Mobile software and then redeeming the Pandora offer. At that point, you need to either create a Pandora account or log into an existing one. Each weekend, you'll need to watch short messages, but after that, you can listen to a personalized station without any more ads. You know, we've been talking about cord cutting with cable subscribers. Hey, the true term is cable subscribers switching the cord. Cable subscribers have been cutting the cord, or more precisely, switching the cord. The Pew Research Center documents the demographics trends in a new report. Cable and satellite TV use has dropped dramatically in the United States since 2015. The share of Americans who say they watch television via cable or satellite has plunged from 76% in 2015 to 56% this year, according to a new Pew Research Center survey of U.S. adults. Some 71% of those who do not use cable or satellite services says it's because they can access the content they want online, while 69% say the cost of cable and satellite service is much too high, and 45% say they do not often watch TV. The drop in cable and satellite subscribers highlights the changing landscape of connectivity and media in an era of cord cutting, particularly as internet streaming services like Netflix and Hulu have grown in popularity, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Among those who do not currently subscribe to cable satellite TV, 61% report that they have done so in the past, while 39% say they have never been subscribers, which is a pretty high number. When applying these findings to the population as a whole, this means that 27% of U.S. adults are cord cutters and 17% have never had a cable or satellite subscription, according to the survey, which, by the way, was conducted between January 25th to February 8th of this year. The decline in cable and satellite TV subscribers since 2015 shows up across the demographic spectrum. The trend among different age groups are particularly striking. Only about a third, that's 34%, of Americans ages 18 to 29 now get TV through cable or satellite, down 31 percentage points from 2015. Fewer than half, 46% of those ages 30 to 49 currently get TV that way, down 27 points. Among those 50 and older, the decline has been less dramatic. Those ages 50 to 64 saw a 14-point drop since 2015. And those 65 and older, which is not a statistically significant difference. Not only do young adults stand out for not using cable or satellite TV, they are also much more likely than their elders to have never gotten a TV at home via cable or satellite. And to say they don't subscribe because they can find the content they want online. Some 61% of those who are ages 18 to 29 don't currently receive TV by cable or satellite say they did not do so in the past, compared with around 3 in 10 in older age groups, and 91% of non-subscribers in this age group say a reason they do not subscribe is that they can access the content they want online, again, a considerably larger share than among older non-subscribers. About half, 53% of non-subscribers ages 18 to 29 say a reason they do not have cable or satellite service at home is because they do not often watch television. That compares with a similar share, 47% of non-subscribers ages 30 to 49 and a third of those 50 and older. A bigger hindrance to older Americans, you guessed it, is cost. Nearly 8 in 10 non-subscribers ages 50 and older say a reason they do not have cable or satellite service is that it is too expensive. Around 7 in 10, 72% non-subscribers ages 30 to 49 say the same thing. But the share who say this is smaller, 57% among non-subscribers ages 18 to 29. These changes in the media landscape have been unfolding after cable service in the United States hit peak market penetration about a decade ago. The move to streaming services has been accompanied by a rise of mobile connectivity through smartphones. The rise of app-based streaming services and smart TVs, industry-targeted research last summer showed that 55% of U.S. households have two or more streaming services. We know that the drop isn't uniform across the country. It differs by region, and it's not uniformly spread across age groups. Pew does a nice job of documenting this. The age 65 and older demographic only dropped by 5% during the period, while ages 18 through 29 dropped a whopping 30%. The report underlines the need for all content producers and channels to be seeking online multi-channel solutions. That's where an increasing amount of audience lives, and it strengthens the case for more sustainable and diversified solutions for funding local content and training. At the same time, people should not give up on the usefulness of a cable channel, whether for broad delivery to about half of the population, which is still a big number, or particularly for services to older Americans. A recent tech journal published an article that supports the view that you need the best computer available to run the best programming language. The article then proceeded to identify the best notebooks on the market that supports the best programming language. They did not identify the best programming language, but they reviewed a list of laptops that supported Python as a programming language. The factors they identified that qualifies these notebooks as being able to support the best programming language are best processors, best solid-state devices, and the best keyboard. Then they identified the top-end product offering from each of the major manufacturers. This included the Google Pixelbook Go. I would call this article an opinion piece that is an infomercial disguised as a technical review. Unfortunately, there are many technical articles reviewing technical products that are not based on any acceptable standards. The fact that you can run Python, the programming language, on the Raspberry Pi Zero, a $5 card, should tell you that you did not have to finish reading the article. Is Python the best programming language? It is a popular programming language, but it is not a universal programming language that fits the need to develop any and all applications. There is no one best computer programming language. The best computer programming language does not exist. The computer press is forever promoting the latest programming language as if it was the soup du jour. I find that with every programming language, I am exposed to solving problems in new and interesting ways. No language is perfect. The problem with arguments about the best programming language is that any claim you could possibly make in favor of one language over another is fraught with exceptions. It is easy to find exceptions and counterpoints that poke holes in every argument. When programmers bring up language features in an argument, it is generally safer to stick to the argument that a language is better because it has more features or better features. As soon as you try to point to specific features, those features expose the reality of trade-offs. Is it better for a language to have garbage collection or direct control of memory? Is dynamic or static typing better? Should the language be primarily procedural, functional, or object-oriented? What about concurrency support, first-class functions, metaprogramming, generic blocks or closures? Every additional features add complexity to the language and cognitive load to the programmers that use it. I like the quote that more is not better or worse than less, just different. It's commonly taken for granted that high-level languages are better for programmer productivity, and we continue to pursue higher levels of abstraction. But sometimes programming in lower-level languages can be more productive. Even seemingly safe arguments like "no one still codes in assembly" aren't always true. Assembly may seem like a dead language that is only useful as a good learning experience, but there are still real-world cases where it is necessary. Each language is expressive and powerful in the domains that it's good for. The bottom line is that it depends on the context. Programmers can and will write bad code in any programming language. At the same time, great software that adds tremendous value can also be written in almost any programming language. The best programming language may not exist, but there are plenty of good ones out there for writing great software. And unfortunately, programming is treated as a common aptitude that everyone has. Unfortunately, we have politicians trivializing programming. They have been pushing the idea of phasing out coal production and dependence-ending coal mining jobs, saying anybody who can throw coal into a furnace can learn how to program. They're also saying that anybody who can go down 3,000 feet in a mine can sure as hell learn to program as well. That's not true. There's a certain aptitude that's required to do good programming. Just like anyone can sing, but if you don't have the aptitude to sing well, it won't sound good at all. Do you still use a device with a mechanical hard drive in it? Flash storage has become so cheap and ubiquitous that outside of backup systems and network-attached systems, solid-state drives and flash memory now hold the data on most of our devices. Hard drive shipments peaked back in 2015, and fewer now are sold every year. But in terms of terabytes sold, hard drives are more important than ever. With web storage and backups, we're dumping more of our data into the cloud. And add in the artificial intelligence and big data, and global server capacity is increasing faster than ever. Flash is making inroads in servers, but physical hard disk storage still form the backbone of data farms. Larger drives have a lot of advantages for server operators. A bigger disk has greater areal density, which is how much data is stored per square inch, which can improve disk speed, and swapping larger disks into an existing system is almost always a cheaper way to boost capacity than building out new server racks. Disk capacity has continued to grow steadily, but with the recent 16-terabyte and 18-terabyte drives, we're approaching the limits of conventional technology. It works like this. Hard drives store data by changing the polarity of magnetic bits on the drive platter. Essentially, they write data by changing these bits so magnetic north is pointing either up or down. These bits are arranged into concentric rings called tracks. You can increase the storage capacity of a hard drive in a few ways. Add more disk, which is called platters. Add more tracks per platters, or make the bits smaller, which is to increase the bits per track. Each of these have a few problems, though. For one, we're just out of space to add platters. An 18-terabyte drive may be cramming 9 platters into a standard hard drive enclosure. Adding more bits or tracks have their own problems, too. To make either smaller, you also need to shrink the write head. If the head is too much larger than the track or the bits, you're liable to accidentally overwrite neighboring bits when you try to write, like trying to use giant marker to write on narrow line paper. You can shrink the write head, but this makes it harder to generate the magnetic field needed to write data. You can cope with this by changing the platter material, by lowering its coercivity or how resistant it is to outside magnetic fields. But this introduces a new problem. At the scale of nanoparticles, like those on a hard drive, materials with low coercivity have a tendency to randomly flip their magnetic polarity. That's not good if you want a reliable long-term data storage. The solution, however, may be two new techniques now called microwave and heat-assisted magnetic recording, or with the acronym MAMR and HAMR. These use an energy source, either a microwave-generating device called a spin-torque oscillator, or a laser, or change the platter material coercivity. This, coupled with a more stable platter material and a smaller write head, lets you pack more data onto each platter. Toshiba just shipped the first MAMR drive, an 18-terabyte model, earlier this month. And MAMR drives from Western Digital are expected shortly. Seagate has a 20-terabyte drive out to enterprise partners, and we may get consumer versions of those as well. It's still early days with both of these bits of technology, but drives made with these methods, collectively called energy-assisted magnetic recording, EAMR, should enable drives up to 60 terabytes and possibly beyond. Add other changes like dual-actuator designs that could double read speeds, and hard drives could see huge improvements in the next few years. No, the hard disk drive is still with us, and because its capability to have very high capacity, and with all that cloud computing, it'll be around. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell with Upsides of Tech and Business Force.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we address some of what's going on in the workplace, and we try to help you navigate through all of the crazy technology that comes along. And last week, I went off on a number of different areas where technology is not helping us in the workplace. From the levels of addiction that we are not going to be able to free ourselves from, all the way across the board to, yes, all of these different metrics of monitoring us, monitoring what we do, how much work we do, how successful we are, and so forth. And that can be a hindrance for us because it also drives us deeper into that technology, which we cannot avoid. Now, this week, I want to touch on the other side of this. The other side, which is technology in the workplace, is actually very empowering. One of the things I love to do is streamline repetitive processes. I love to work with automation to make things better. And there are a number of different things we can do to increase our speed. Just setting up simple macros, keyboard macros, or different macros in Excel can speed things along. Utilizing different formulas over and over and over again, you know, you create the formula once, but you apply that formula in a number of different areas. You go, hey, I love this formula. As a matter of fact, most people I know who work with Excel have a favorite Excel tool or macro or formula that they love to use. One of the things I love to use is within Outlook, you can set up just a simple quick macro to sort out your mail. And just by, you know, I hit Shift Control 1 if I want mail routed to one folder, Shift Control 2 for another folder, and Shift Control 3 for another folder. And I have a repetitive email that I send out on a regular basis, three of them actually, and they are 7, 8, and 9. Shift Control 7, 8, and 9. Another thing, too, the ability for us, we used to, if you were such that you had a cell phone and you were high enough in the company, you might be also assigned a cell phone. Today's technology actually allows us to utilize this idea of BYOD, bring your own device. Now, yes, most companies are actually offering up some kind of fiscal benefit for you doing that. Some of them don't. And I've never really worried about it just because I like the idea of being free from their reins, being independent of what they're doing. But you know what? That's still okay. That's perfectly fine. The ease of access to information is another wonderful area that has been brought to the workplace, the marketplace. I will tell you that if I need certain information within my company that I work for, I can search for it. I can search for a number of different things that are around. So that actually is really good. The idea of all of us working from home, how many of us are working from home? This is going to be a recurring theme for at least a number of more months. But how many of us are able to still hold down a job to keep money coming in because of technology? I know my wife and I both. My son, he's able to do that. I know a number of different people that in different companies that are all doing just fine because, yeah, they've moved into the dining room, or they've moved into the spare bedroom and they've created their own little office area. But now they're working and they're continuing on with almost the same level of productivity. So there's a lot to all of this. Better communication. I will tell you that we're able, all right, nothing will replace in-person communication or voice communications. But I'll tell you that, yes, moving along with communication options that we have now, you want to reach somebody when they're not at their desk? You want to send them a key report? Yeah, email, instant message. You need information from someone. You've got 5 different people to reach out to. You can send one email, ask all 5 of them, hey, I need an answer to this question. Anybody got the answer? And one of them will likely reach out and give you that information. Innovation has really brought so much to the workplace. So many different things have come along that have enabled us in technology. I will tell you that I am just amazed at all of the different realms that we're now able to take advantage of. Yes, this ranges from whether we're talking about learning or we're talking about moving money around. Or we're even talking about, I know someone who is disabled, they're in a wheelchair, and they're perfectly fine working just alongside of us, like nothing else is going on, nothing, you know, they're wheelchair bound, but you know what, they still have a brain, and they're enabled to do what they want, and that's great. I think that is absolutely awesome. Disability is no longer a hindrance. It's no longer an issue. So there you go. There's a lot of different things, and yes, I'm only hitting the, just scratching the surface here. Yeah, there were disadvantages. There are advantages, and both combined, yes, I like to look on the bright side. I think all of this is working out just fine. Technology has made us much better for it. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. When we get to the post-pandemic, how will the work office transform? It's been 1 year since COVID-19 was declared a pandemic, and businesses started closing. In March 2020, companies across the United States abruptly closed their offices and instructed employees to work from home indefinitely as a result of the pandemic. At first, many thought the shutdowns would last just a couple of months, but 1 year later, millions of workers are still working remotely. The pandemic has forced a large segment of the global workforce to go through a remote work experiment on a scale never seen before. The boundary between our work and our personal lives has become, well, blurred. Working at the kitchen table has become uncommon, and for parents, juggling virtual school while trying to hit work deadlines has become a daily challenge. Employers have also been forced to become more flexible. They had to loosen restrictions on where employees can work, equip them with the tools to do so, and support them with both professionally and personally. We've learned many lessons as a result. Meetings aren't always necessary. Working a standard 8-hour shift may not be the best schedule for everyone. Sitting at a desk doesn't always mean you're being productive, and perhaps you miss your coworkers more than you thought you would. Now that more people are getting vaccinated and kids are getting back to school, well, hopefully they are, things appear as if they might get back to normal, but the workplace as we know it might have changed forever. Some companies plan to remain 100% remote post-pandemic, while others will take a hybrid approach, giving workers more flexibility about where they work, and some companies will want everyone to come back. Workers and employers can expect to hit a few bumps in the road as they navigate the next phase in return to work in the office. Many companies succeeded working remotely in 2020, largely because everyone was doing it. There was no built-in preferences for office workers or stigma against remote workers. Hybrid is going to make managing this difference harder. Back on March 11th last year, 2020, companies across the globe were shutting down their offices and many had little to no time to prepare their employees for getting work done entirely outside of office walls. Many IT departments had to scramble to find laptops for workers, primarily sales employees, when it went remote in March. From the start, companies focused on making sure workers were well-equipped at their home office by allowing things like tech equipment and noise-canceling headphones to be expensed, as well as offering subsidies for high-speed internet. But it wasn't just figuring out the logistics of how to work from home that challenged employers and their workers at the start of the pandemic. There was the mental and emotional toll it took as well. Some companies enhanced their benefits, offering things like free counseling, stipends for childcare, and office setups and increased days off. But when it comes to the workforce post-pandemic, remote work will no longer be considered a special perk. It no longer do you offer remote work, but if you do offer it with enough organizational support, so I can be successful as the people who work in the office. It is projected about 60% of the companies will offer a hybrid work model, while 30% of the companies will be back in the office and 10% will be fully remote. It will get harder in 2021 with hybrid. Inequality between remote and in-office workers can become an issue among hybrid workforces. People in the office get more face time with the boss, which can lead to, of course, obviously, a better relationship, increased access to information and top assignments. Training managers on how to equally incorporate remote and in-person workers in the meeting and decision-making, as well as how they communicate, is a critical step in equalizing workforces. There will be logistic issues, such as scheduling workers to come into the office for an important meeting if people move away. Workers who move to areas with significantly higher or lower cost of labor can see their pay adjusted. Teleconferencing may be great, but there's no equivalent of getting people together and fostering a common culture. As things start to return to normal and services like daycare reopen regularly, employers will likely become stricter with their remote working requirements. That could mean requiring the employee have childcare in place during the working hours or standardizing a time zone that everyone can work in. The other thing that does come up with anywhere work is tax laws. That can get tricky and complex. Should an employee move to an area where a company doesn't already have employees or an office, it could bring administrative and tax burdens to the employer. Relocating could also affect workers' tax bills if they work in one state but live in another. Companies will also likely need less office space as more employees start working remotely. To meet the needs of a hybrid workforce, office designs are likely going to look different as well. There is a psychological impact. Life has been shaken quite a bit, and there are multiple ramifications of this. Not every worker will need a designated desk. Collaborative spaces would likely become a bigger priority so that more team-focused work can happen in the office while individual work will be done at home. Even as more people become vaccinated, experts warn that it's going to take time to return to any sense of normalcy at work. There is no question that there is a psychological impact of this that is lasting. Life has been shaken quite a bit, and there are multiple ramifications of this. Companies are not aware some remote workers have moved. What happened when offices reopen? Not everybody's going to come back. While millions of Americans suddenly working remotely, some took unprecedented opportunity to shift their lives in a new direction, crossing their fingers that when it's safe to go back to the office, they won't have to. David Lewis is a CEO of Operations Inc., a human resources consulting firm in Connecticut, said that many of his clients have seen employees suddenly move out of state and they just roll with it. It wasn't frowned upon as much as it probably would have prior to COVID-19. Now I think that the day of reckoning is coming. He predicts that more than half of companies that allow remote work will continue to, or at least part-time, and companies should think hard before being heavy-handed in ordering people back to the office from wherever they are, he says. The good news is you could get everybody back to the office. The bad news is not everybody is going to come back. When it comes to those workers who have already moved, Lewis says it depends on who those workers are. If they're valued employees and they're productive ones and they have continued to be productive while working in this COVID world, chances are organizations are going to allow them to continue to do that. For employers, moving brings costs and benefits. A PwC survey of 1,200 U.S. office workers currently working remotely found that when the pandemic recedes, 29% want to work remotely 5 days a week, and 55% said they'd like to be remote at least 3 days a week. Company leaders are a bit less enthusiastic about that. A parallel survey of executives found that 68% believe workers should be in the office at least 3 days a week to maintain company culture, and 65% believe the office is very important to increasing employee productivity. Bhushan Sethi, who leads PwC's workforce strategy practice, says that whether companies allow significant remote work will depend on what industry they're in, the size of their real estate footprint, and whether they have a lot of young workers to train. But there are some big potential upsides for employers to remote work. Companies can hire talent in places they couldn't before. And offering remote jobs can mean gaining or losing an edge in attracting and retaining talent. Presenting All Hands on Tech with Marty Winston, with lots of meeting cheating.
You may regard this as fact or opinion, but let's start with it. Meetings waste more time than they save. The theory is that they let all the participants catch up with each other's status all at once, so everybody stays in sync, and so the organizer or leader can harvest status updates all at once and issue everyone new instructions and priorities all at once. Now, have you ever seen a meeting that worked out that way? Before the pandemic, many organizations made meetings an unavoidable part of the daily routine. Even when meetings happened live and in the same room, when you looked around, what did you see? Notebook PCs were open, and tablets or smartphones were on the table. But why? What were the people using them doing with them? Most of the time, it had nothing to do with the meeting or anything relevant to the meeting, only a small fraction of the sentience in the room, of the intelligence of the human gray matter in the room, was being devoted to the subject being discussed. Many attendees were catching up on email, browsing the web, or almost anything that would let them use their time more productively than enduring the meeting's routines. At any moment, no matter how many people were present, only a very few were active participants. And that was where cheating at meetings began. But online meetings have evolved that cheating into an art form, and for good reason. It started when more people were suddenly working from home. Factor in the many options through which it became so easy to schedule online meetings involving any number of others, and those meetings may now be virtual, but when it comes to lost productivity, they are no less impactful as a monkey on the back of participants. So how can you tell when there's an online meeting to which the participants are devoting far less than their full attention? One telltale sign is right there on the screen. Notice how few of the participants are appearing in live video and how many just appear as flashing initials. How many of their microphones are muted? Why do you suppose that is? Might they be involved in other calls during the meeting? Might they be chatting with people in the room? It's a lot like the days before contemporary online meetings when everybody gathered in the conference room with the expensive speakerphone and almost everybody's phone was on mute. But hey, check it out yourself. If you ever have occasion to visit an organization where online meetings are commonplace, just keep your eyes open. Note how many people with meetings on their screens are working on email or paper mail, submitting expense reports, texting, muting the meeting while making or taking phone calls, or even simply muting their mics and then leaving the room. If you happen to be a higher-up in an organization where you suspect there's a lot of cheating at meetings and not much productivity to show for it, here are a couple of thoughts. Some businesses report significant increases in productivity after cutting meeting lengths that had been a full hour to just 30 minutes. Even better if the highest level managers in those meetings keep, stalking opportunities to get meetings to end after just 10 to 15 minutes. And some businesses are establishing blocks of time that are mandated meeting-free, so people can get up out of their chairs, see other people, and get more done in a 3-minute chat than tends to get done in a 30-minute meeting. Enough of the dark side of wasted productivity. There's something new at Staples.com. Well, the products are new and innovative, but the underlying technology is even older than old school. It's paper and ink, literally. No matter how devout a Microsoft Office devotee you may be, there are limits. How do you add a sketch to a page? How do you run lines and arrows between things you write down or circle them? That's a glimpse at what there is to like in the new True Red. That's T-R-U, no E, T-R-U, then R-E-D, True Red. With an expert note-taking collection of bound journals and gel pens that you may just find liberating. For example, the 5-inch by 8-inch Explore journal features pages with lines and columns of equally spaced light gray dots, light enough not to get in your way, but a great spacing guide for sketches, diagrams, freehand tables, and so on. There's also an 8-inch by 10-inch starter journal with lined pages, unlined page sections, page dating, perforated day, hours, note, and checkbox sections, and other features. These are formatted that way to be great tools for everything, from project tracking to time management and more. Not to neglect having room for jotting down the notes that are a challenge to add in other formats. Even better, the Mastery Journal, also 8 inches by 10 inches, is narrow-ruled with index hashes for adding column lines, 3 page mark ribbons, top corner dog ear bookmarks, and a pocket-sized portable booklet you can stow in its rear cover piggyback pouch. There's also an inside front cover pocket and a front section made for indexing the contents that you create in it. Those pens, quick-dry, retractable gel pens that dodge smudges, very handy for annotating different kinds of content on the same page while keeping it easy to identify and find them individually. You might be tempted to say that True Red proves how much old-school tools can rule, but in truth, old-school was never this good. The True Red note-taking collection underscores the pro in productivity, with thoughtful features that may resemble older ways, but also manifest their evolution. That's at staples.com. Next time, even in the last few months of the pandemic era, there is still spring cleaning to do. But until that pandemic era passes, it's spring cleaning with a few new twists. Gang, this isn't Good Housekeeping Magazine. Be here for our report, Spring Cleaning and Tech in a Pandemic Era. And wipe your feet before you come in.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meeting through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. The Brookdale Computer Users Group, that's BCUG, meets Thursday, March the 25th, 2021, and the meeting time is 6:45 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting. Their website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group meets Thursday, April the 1st, 2021, at 7 p.m., and that's not an April Fool joke. Via Zoom virtual meeting, their website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, April the 2nd, 2021. Meeting time is 8 p.m. via Jitsi Meet. Their website is acgnj.org. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, April the 8th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and the website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, April the 9th, 2021. Meeting time is 7 p.m. via Zoom virtual meeting, and their website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email address to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.